Welcome, everybody. This is the seventh lecture for the Mises Academy online class, Basics of Economics, the Free Market. It is February 20th, 2014, and tonight we are talking about profit and loss accounting. So this is, again, one of the chapters that I say in the textbook is a little bit advanced. It's not so much that the material is that difficult, but we go into it in more depth than we had in earlier chapters. So some of this stuff, if the main themes are going to be repeated from what we've seen before, but we're just going to push it a little bit deeper. Okay, so first of all, let me draw your attention, just coincidentally, Tom Woods had me on recently on his show. And by the way, if you guys aren't listening to his podcast, you really should. It's my favorite podcast now. I'm doing my checkbook or something. This is the thing I want to have going in the background. And so I gave you the YouTube link here. You don't need to do this for this course. You know, I'm not going to quiz you on it or anything, but it's what it was is there was a guy, Jesse Meyerson, who wrote an article for Rolling Stone called something like Five Political Reforms That Would Help Millennials or something like that. And it was, what's funny is, so Tom and I are talking about this thing because apparently it went viral. And so that's why Tom wanted to smash it. And this guy, like the writer, we're sitting there lamenting as we're going through it on this particular episode of the Tom Woods Show. And I say several times, you know, no, Tom, I mean, it's like this guy doesn't even understand the problem of socialism. I mean, we could take his argument to its logical conclusion and just say we ought to have communism. And what's funny is it turns out this guy, Meyerson, actually is a communist. Because we started arguing with Tom and I were having a Twitter war with him today. And the guy's own, you know, his Twitter profile says quite clearly, like, hashtag full communism or something like that. And at first I thought maybe he was just doing it tongue-in-cheek. But people have pointed me to other stuff he's written where he says something like, you know, what modern people don't understand about communism or something like that, or how the intellectuals today unfairly dismiss Marx or something like that, which I think Tom and Peter Klein talked about in a different episode of the Tom Woods Show. So anyway, if you want to hear a sort of more banterish take on a lot of the stuff that we're talking about in tonight's lecture, you can go to hear Tom Woods and I talk about it, because we hit a lot of these issues, but there's a lot of specific examples of things that I'm not going to be able to get into tonight, just to see the different context in which these broad themes come out in reaction to. So in other words, this guy Meyerson and his five suggestions for political reform that would help millennials, he doesn't understand anything that we're going to talk about in tonight's lecture, because if he did, he would realize everything he said in his article is just completely blown up. Okay, so at a basic level, you know, just to get us going here, what you should understand when it comes to free market economics is the idea that prices guide production. And so we have enough knowledge at this point, if you've been doing the reading and listening to the lectures up till now, that you can start to understand how it is that a market economy organizes production. So if you sit back for a minute or stand back for a minute and just think about the big picture, what do we know about the market economy? Well, it's free. It's voluntary. Nobody forces anybody to produce anything. Okay? There's a very legitimate sense and you're allowed to choose the occupation or the occupations, plural, into which you want to go. There's not a guild system as there was, you know, in centuries past where maybe you had to be a cobbler because that's what your dad was, or your dad was a blacksmith, and so you had to do that. Or if you wanted to become a blacksmith, you know, there was this official procedure you had to go through, and you had to be assigned to somebody and, you know, be an apprentice for a long time, journeyman, and they have all kinds of different levels and so forth. Okay, we don't have that, at least in a pure free market economy. We actually, in practice, do have things like that because of government intervention. But in a pure free market economy, you wouldn't have things like that. If you wanted to be a brain surgeon and you had no training and no medical license or anything, so there wouldn't be necessarily licenses provided by the government. There wouldn't be a government. kind of system we're thinking of right now, or at least the government wouldn't be providing medical licenses. Okay, so you can do whatever you want. You're free to, but that raises the question of, well, hang on, surely that would lead to, you know, anarchy in the bad sense, in the pejorative sense. Wouldn't there be chaos if everyone can just do whatever they want? And you can imagine if you went back in time and spoke to people who lived when there was the guild system, and said to them, you know, I don't like this system you guys have. It's not fair. Why do you strictly regulate what occupations people can choose? You know, shouldn't people be free to do whatever they want? Who are you to boss people around and force them into one occupation or another? And they would probably say, well, yeah, that's nice to talk about freedom and whatever, but we're being realistic. If we don't have enough farmers, then we're going to starve to death. If we don't have enough cobblers, no one's going to have shoes. If we don't have enough blacksmiths, you know, we're not going to have enough horseshoes and tools and things like that. So, you know, what are you talking about? We have to strictly regulate this stuff to ensure that the right things get produced. So, or in more modern times, like in the 1800s, the arguments there weren't so much between people defending a guild system versus what we would consider now a free market, but rather the argument was between capitalism and socialism. And so the socialists, looking at the capitalist system, were saying, there's this anarchy of production. This is crazy. There's no rationality involved here. Why don't we have a bunch of experts determine what should be produced? And that will lead to a much more sensible, fair, efficient, productive output or mix of goods that are produced. You know, we have scarce resources. We can't produce everything. If we produce more of one good, that means we have fewer resources to produce other possible goods. And so somehow society needs to choose, or there needs to be rules in place or procedures in place by which some members of society make particular decisions. And the socialist thinks that their approach is much more rational and humane. Okay, so what we're trying to focus on in today's lecture is to get you to understand the mechanism by which the decentralized free market economy that rests on private property and money, how does that determine production? All right, and it's, some people might not like to even use that terminology because they want to say, no, the whole beauty of the market is there's no one thing determining everything. It's just this humongous spontaneous outcome. But there's a sense in which obvious things happen in a market economy so that people don't just all starve to death next Tuesday because, oh my gosh, not enough people became farmers. Okay, so what I'm saying is the sort of drills that we've been going over up till now are going to help us in the game, to use a sports analogy, right? That we were practicing layups and practicing free throws, and now we're going to go play a game, and we're going to use those skills. So, you know, I walked you through the supply and demand curves and how do you use them, and it may have seemed like, well, why are you going through all this stuff? Well, because now we're in a better position to see how the market responds to things. So if we focus for a second on the orange example, forget what you know about economics and markets for a second. If we have just some kind of social system, we have limited resources, and then just suppose the weather is really good, and now we have a bunch of oranges, way more oranges than we had before, or that we would have in a normal season. What would you want? What would be a sensible thing for that social system to do? Well, clearly, people should eat more oranges, and there should be more orange juice made, and all kinds of recipes and things that use oranges should be given, you know, should be favored. All right, so that's the way society ought to react to the fact that the orange crop is bigger this year than it normally is. And, you know, so if you had a socialist system and all the weather was really great and the more oranges came in than the plan had predicted, you would hope that the socialist central planners would tweak their numbers and now, like, raise the orange ration for everybody. So now instead of everyone getting two oranges a week, they get three oranges a week if, you know, if the crop is 50% bigger than they thought it would be. You get the idea. Okay, so in a market, though, what happens? Well, we've seen with those supply and demand charts what happens, that because of the increased harvest, you would make the supply curve of oranges. Let me draw here. So here's the original supply and demand for oranges, and then the supply curve shifts to the right. So that test one and that test two. So what happens is the price goes down, and the equilibrium quantity goes up. Obviously, it'd be easier to see that if I had more space to work with. Okay, but I'm just reproducing the analysis we did for good weather and the orange crop increase. All right, so we walked through the mechanics of that, so we're just looking very narrowly at, okay, how does the supply curve move? Does the demand curve move? But now we're kind of looking at the big picture and saying, what does that mean? What implications does this have? Well, it's showing you when there's good weather and then there's a big orange crop, what happens? In a decentralized market economy with no government intervention, what's going to happen is the price of oranges is going to fall, and then with the existing demand curve at the lower price, the quantity demanded will increase. So again, it's not that demand increases, but the quantity demanded increases as you move along that demand curve because prices fall, because supply shifted to the right. So you end up getting what you want, that more people now are eating oranges. And if you're a company that produces orange juice, now you see the price of one of your inputs drop, namely the price of oranges. So you reevaluate and you end up making more orange juice because now it's cheaper too. Okay, different example. So notice that's exactly what you want to have. Different example that I talk about in the textbook. People going into dentistry. And how do they know exactly what they want to specialize in? You know, so somebody, when he's young, he realizes, yeah, you know, I want to kind of go into medicine or something in some way. And then it ends up the person wants to become a dentist. And there's various ways you can do it. You know, you could be a dentist who kind of just sees people for regular checkups. You could be somebody who specializes in giving older people dentures. Or you could be an orthodontist and specialize in giving people retainers and installing braces. And the point is, what guides that? When you can't just say, well, people do whatever they want, because then what if no one wants to be the guy who actually has to go in and do a reconstructive surgery when somebody's face is really messed up in a car accident? You know, that's kind of gross. Maybe people would rather do something, or maybe some people say, no, I'd rather just put in braces rather than have to do just standard, you know, looking at people who come in for a regular checkup, because that's kind of boring. All right. But how does the market sort of regulate and ensure that there's the right amount of people doing the various tasks? Because prices adjust. If there aren't enough orthodontists installing braces on people, well, then the supply of that service is going to go way down, and that means the price is going to go way up. And so now the price of getting braces is going to be much higher. And so as younger people are getting older and deciding what they're going to do with their lives, they can look and see, wow, you earn a lot of money as an orthodontist if you just sit there all day and install braces on people, because, you know, they're willing to pay so much for it because there's not that many people doing it. And so that gives you an incentive on the margin to do that compared to something else. All right, so that's, in a nutshell, how the market economy works and how it regulates people's activities, because there's like a feedback mechanism. Yes, you are nominally free to do whatever you want. Nobody can literally force you to choose one occupation or the other. But at the same time, nobody can force consumers to pay you. So yeah, if you want to, on a purely free market, if you want to be a brain surgeon, you could open up shop and say, hey, come on over and, you know, I'll perform operations for half the price of what the competitors are charging. But no one's going to get on your table if you haven't been to medical school. You have no idea what you're doing. Right? So you're going to very quickly starve if that's your approach to, if that's what you want to do with your occupation if you've never gone to medical school. Okay? So that's the way the market economy works. So yes, there's freedom, but there has to be some way by which everyone else in society sort of registers his or her opinion with you as to whether you're using your talents in a way that they like. I'm kind of being vague here, but we'll make it a little more concrete as the lecture continues. Okay, so Friedrich Hayek wrote a lot on this subject. Some of his famous essays, if you want to go look them up, so you don't need to for this course, but if you're an overachiever and want to go look at some of his essays, one of his most famous essays is called Economics and Knowledge. And then another one that's probably even more famous than that is called The Use of Knowledge in Society. So here I'll type those out. Well, let me just type this. The Use of Knowledge in Society. That's probably The Use of Knowledge in Society. You can just Google that and you'll find it. I think that came out in like 1945. That's possibly the most famous essay that Hayek has written. Okay, so his most famous book is The Road to Serfdom, but that particular essay is extremely famous. I actually like his other one better, Economics and Knowledge. I think is more, first of all, I think it came out early. I think that came out in 1937. And in Economics and Knowledge, I think Hayek provides more innovation in terms of pure economic theory. He actually lays the groundwork for what we would now call intertemporal equilibrium. All right, I'm throwing a lot of big words out. I don't mean to scare you guys in case you're young and being homeschooled in this course. I'm just trying to make sure that the older people who love the Mises Institute, you know, get their red meat as well, this lecture. Okay, so, but anyway, the use of knowledge in society, that's actually fairly readable for just a regular person, even if you're not trained economists, whereas economics and knowledge is a little bit more difficult. Okay, so anyway, if you're curious and want to dip your toe in the water and see, you know, can I read this stuff or is it too intimidating, try Hayek's The Use of Knowledge in Society. But in any event, Hayek was very big on looking at market prices as like a communication network. That market prices were like signals. And so he conceived of the market economy, among other metaphors, as just a way that people communicate with each other. And so this isn't Hayek's example, but let me just give you a quick example. So let's say there's a snowstorm. What would normally happen? Well, if people are really worried about not being able to get bottled water and stuff, you might see the price of bottled water and batteries and tuna fish and things like that go really high. Okay, and if you want to use supply and demand curves, you'd say, well, because of the snow, now outside shippers can't get in, so the trucks and whatever that would normally come in and replenish the stockpiles of inventory in the grocery stores, they just can't get into the region because the snowstorm hit. So the supply curve shifted way to the left. And then everyone's panicked and they don't know how long they're going to be snowed in. So everybody rushes to the store and just starts buying up stuff like crazy. So for a given price, people want to buy way more batteries now than they would have before the snowstorm hit. And they want to buy way more water bottles now than they would have before the snowstorm hit. And so on. Okay, so the demand for those types of goods also goes to the right. So you've got a huge restriction in supply, a huge increase in demand. What's going to happen to the price is going to skyrocket. Now, you don't know which way the quantity is going to move because it depends whether the supplier curve shifted more to the left and the demand shifted to the right and what their slopes were. Okay, but for sure, you know the price is going to skyrocket, and that's exactly what you do see happen. Unless the government comes in and threatens to fine you. You also see with gasoline. That's just a quintessential example. When there's a blizzard, for some other kind of disaster, like a flood or something like that, the gas stations often are cut off from the trucks that would come and normally replenish the, you know, the tanks that they have underground. And so in a sense, the supply shifts way to the left, and then people panic and they want to go fill up just to make sure that they have enough gas in their car to get through the crisis. So the demand for gas shifts to the right. So again, the market clearing price of gasoline might go up to $12 a gallon while this crisis happens. And you saw that in New York and New Jersey a while ago, and the allegedly conservative Republican hero Chris Christie came in and threatened to fine gas station owners and whatnot for gouging their customers. Okay, but anyway, in a Hayekian framework, what's going on there is that's just a signal announcing to everybody how scarce the gasoline or the water bottles or the batteries have now become. So it's just a way for us to get information. And so for Chris Christie or Rudy Giuliani or whoever the people were at the time, or was it Bloomberg? I'm getting mixed with it. I guess it was Bloomberg. For them to come in and threaten merchants with fines and other kind of penalties if they raise prices, that hampers the ability of a free people to respond to the situation, to provide emergency relief, right? That it would be as if Chris Christie said, none of the EMT crews are allowed to use walkie-talkies, and they can't use the internet. And I don't want anyone using a cell phone, because that's not fair. I mean, that would be crazy if they did that. That would make it much harder for people to figure out who needs help the most, who's in the most urgent situation and needs our help the most, and so on. Okay, and so by the same token, what happened with the gasoline, with the ban on gouging? If gasoline prices had been allowed to go up to $12 and gas station owners could just freely sell at $12 with no threat from the government, what would happen? And what was happening is people would with trucks and whatever would drive outside of the radius of where the crisis was, and they would fill up on gas where it was cheaper, and then drive back in and then deliver it to people who need the gas. Right? Why would they do well? Because they can make a lot of money doing that. Okay, or with water bottles, if water bottles normally sell for $2 and now they're selling for $6, what's going to happen? Well, Dasani and all the other water companies are going to have an incentive to start shipping truckloads in. Okay, and figuring out ways to get more water in there quickly while the price is so high. So it's not relying on their generosity or their concern for, oh, those poor people, their water got shut off, and so now they're drinking bottled water and they're going to go thirsty. But no, it's just, wow, the price of our product just tripled overnight. Let's send more of our product there. Okay, so that's, you know, the market prices are a signal. Okay. What Hayek used was actually one of his examples. He said that suppose somewhere, I might altering the details a little bit, but the spirit is definitely the same. He said, imagine that somewhere like in Africa, there's a tin mine, you know, T-I-N. It's a mine where they bring tin to the surface and then sell it on the world commodity market. And then there's a collapse in the mine, that something happened, the tunnel caves in, whatever. And so now, at least for a few days, the tin that was normally being brought to market from this particular mine isn't able to get out. There's been an interruption in the supply. So Hayek says, what's going to happen? He says, well, speculators seeing the news of that are going to almost instantly bid up the price of tin in the world commodity markets. All right, so that, you know, they would, be buying futures contracts, technically, if you're familiar with that terminology. Okay, and so ultimately what's going to happen is the world price of tin is going to rise because the supply shifted left using our supply and demand framework. And then what's going to happen because of that? Well, everybody around the world is going to economize on him. And notice, it's not that everyone's going to uniformly reduce their usage. The business enterprises that previously had been using tin, but they could just as well use some other metal, and it's not a big deal. The only reason they were using tin was because it was a little bit cheaper. Well, now if tin is more expensive than some substitute, they'll just use the substitute for a while until tin comes back down in price. Whereas some other operation where, no, they really need to be using tin for some reason, that there really isn't a good substitute, they're not going to reduce how much they do. Or maybe they'll just scale back their own operations. But it's not like they're going to stop using tin and use some other input instead. Okay, so even if the, let's say that the world production of tin, the amount of tin that's brought to market every day drops 5%, and it's 5% lower than normally would be for like a week. Hayek's point is it's not that everybody around the world reduces their usage of tin by 5% for that week. No, some people might cut way back. Some people might not cut back at all. But what is going to happen is in aggregate, the total quantity of tin consumed is going to be 5% lower because it has to be physically. All right, so Hayek's point is that, or one of his points, is to say, notice, that's exactly what we would want to have happen. If you were a central planner just running the world, directing resources, and then a mine collapsed, well, physically, there's just less tin you have to work with until you get that mine up and running. And so you have to tweak the numbers and make it so that collectively everyone around the world uses that much less tin per day because physically you don't have it anymore. But how do you decide which operations are going to cut back and by how much? Well, surely you would do the sort of calculations or considerations that actually do happen in the market economy, where firms that could just as easily switch to something else, you might make them absorb more of the impact or the brunt of reduction. Whereas other operations where, no, they really need to use tin, they can't switch to anything else, then they're going to just... of the remaining tin that's left, they're going to now get priority. And so Hayek is saying, look, that's exactly what happened with the decentralized price system. And he said, also, what's beautiful about it is nobody, like somebody in North America, some operation that's making cars and uses tin and now decides to switch to some other metal, because tin prices shot up 10%, they don't need to know why tin became more scarce. It's not like they need to go read in the newspaper and see, oh, there was a mine collapse in Africa, and that's why now we need to shift away from tin. And all they need to do is look at the prices. And so Hayek is saying that market price communicates information, but very economically. It communicates just enough so that people can adjust their production plans accordingly, but without dwelling on stuff that they really don't need to know. So Hayek's point is the mine collapse means tin has become more scarce than it was yesterday. And all the people really need to know in order to adjust their plans is that tin is more scarce. They don't even know why it's more scarce. That's irrelevant. What they need to know is if you can cut back on tin, then do it. But if not, you're going to pay more. Okay, so... that's some of what Hayek wrote on this. Now, his famous book, Prices and Production, involves what we now call Austrian business cycle theory. But the title, and I don't know how I managed to get so long through my career without realizing this. What he means by the title is that it's changes in relative prices that steer production. Okay, so that's what the title means. And so, now I'm getting into really deep stuff that you won't see until I think the last chapter of the textbook, which we're obviously not covering in this course. But where Hayek is coming from, he's taking the business cycle theory that Mises developed and just elaborating on it. And so he's saying that when banks engage in artificial credit expansion, that lowers interest rates. And so it makes it changes the relative prices, and it makes certain operations look more profitable than they really should be, and so businesses start producing more on those lines. And so he's saying that that's what ends up causing the unsustainable boom. It's the fact that the credit expansion changes relative prices, and hence the name of the title of his book, Prices and Production. He's saying the impact of changes in relative prices upon production decisions. Okay, so following up on that point, after I just got through telling you that prices guide entrepreneurs and that, oh, if oranges become cheaper, well, then consumers buy more oranges, and if tin becomes more expensive, well, then firms will economize and use less tin. I mean, those statements are true, but strictly speaking, entrepreneurs are not guided so much by prices as they are by what they expect to be price differences, or I think Rothbard calls them price differentials. So it's what I mean is it's profits that guide them, right? So it's not that, oh, if I expect, or it's not so much that you would say the entrepreneur is going to go into those lines where they expect the price of the finished product to be highest, because then you'd say, oh, so everybody ought to be selling houses and nobody ought to be producing candy bars, because the price of a finished house is way higher than the price of a candy bar. So if you sort of naively and simplistically thought that I was telling you, oh, in a market economy, producers tend to flock to those areas where consumers are willing to spend the most and have the highest prices, no, that's clearly not true. Because again, then that means everybody who's in business would just produce mansions or would just produce space shuttles that have a price tag of $3 billion or whatever. And nobody would produce bubble gum and nobody would produce packs of gum, because all those are so cheap, people aren't going to pay us much for those. So if you just think through, well, wait a minute, there's obviously some flaw with that line of thinking. What's the flaw? It's that, well, houses cost more to produce, and space shuttles cost way to have more to produce, whereas it doesn't cost very much to make a candy bar. It doesn't cost very much to make a pack of gum. And so really what guides entrepreneurs is the expected profits. And if you really want to get technical about it, it would be the rate of return on their investment. That's ultimately what they're interested in. So if you have a given amount of capital and you're looking at various projects in which to invest, really the consideration is to say, if when you say have $1 million to invest, you want to say what's going to give me the highest rate of return on my money, or that's one of the considerations. You also would want to worry about how safe is this investment? You know, am I quite confident that I'm going to get my money out, or is it possible, or is it very likely that this is going to go bankrupt? That sort of thing too. So you don't just blindly do the thing promising the highest rate of return. That's certainly a consideration. So what I'm saying is, as far as just the benefit, you know, putting aside for the moment the safety or the riskiness of it, or the uncertainty is a better word from an Austrian perspective, it's not so much the revenues that you care about, and it's not even so much the gross profit, but rather the percentage profit. All right, so what do I mean by that? Well, if there's one project that you can earn $100,000 profit on, you think, and there's another one where you're only earn $50,000 profit, you might think, oh, wouldn't you want to get the $100,000? But what if that first project requires you to invest $1 million of capital, whereas the second one only requires you to invest $1,000 of capital? Well, now those are different things. Okay, so it's not even just the absolute amount of dollar profit that you think you're going to get. It's actually based on relative as a percentage of how much you're investing. So ultimately, it comes back to how much profit do you want to get. But the point is, if you invest in those lines where the rate of return is the highest, then that is what's going to ultimately give you the bigger dollar amount of total profit. Okay. Let me just talk to you about this slide here. I just want to make sure you don't misunderstand. Here's the basic story. So the idea is entrepreneurs, they look out at the world and they are going to be drawn to areas where they see, where they're looking at how much you have to spend on the inputs and compare that with how much you have, the consumers are going to spend on the outputs, you know, the finished products, and they're looking at that gap. And they're trying to figure out which areas have the highest rate of return for me to possibly invest my resources, including my time. And again, you got to adjust for some things have more uncertainty than others. Okay. Now, because there's competition, there's a tendency that if everything stayed the same, if consumer tastes stayed the same, if technology stayed the same, if the amount of resources we had to work with stayed the same, if, you know, entrepreneurs in terms of the ideas they had for new products and things like that, if that just was static, well, then over time you would expect all of the rates of return in the various industries to be whittled down to a common uniform rate of return. Okay, so let's just say there was one sector where entrepreneurs could get in and they were earning 12% per year. So that, you know, they would spend $100 on inputs, you know, hiring workers, buying raw materials, things like that. And then 1 year later they would sell the finished product for $112. So they're earning 12%, whereas in some other line they're only earning 8%. What would happen is the entrepreneurs who were in the industry that were earning 8%, they would say, wait a minute, we can make more going over there where they're earning 12. And so some of them would flock over to the one earning 12. Right? And so what would happen? Well, several things. As some producers left the sector that's only earning 8%, that means the supply is going to go down of whatever that good or service is, right? Now there's fewer producers. So at any given price, there's going to be less output brought to the market because some of the producers just left or they're doing something else now. So that means the supply shifts to the left. So in terms of the finished retail price of whatever that good or service is, the price is going to go up now. The opposite happens in the sector earning where the return is 12%. As more producers pile in, the supply of whatever that good or service is going to increase. So that means the market price is going to get pushed down. Okay, but that's not the only effects, or those aren't the only effects. Look at it now in terms of the prices for the inputs in these two sectors. So in the first sector, remember, some of the producers are leaving because the rate of return there is only 8%. So they start leaving. What's going to happen? Well, they're going to shut down their businesses or lay off workers or whatever. So wages and the price of the inputs, like if you have to use tin in that first sector where the rate of return is 8%, now if there's fewer producers, that means they're not as many of them are going to be trying to buy tin. So the demand for labor in that sector goes down. The demand for tin goes down, demand for gasoline or electricity or whatever goes down. So other things equal, is the demand for something goes down, what happens? The price falls. Right? So that means for the producers who stay in that sector, what do they see? The price that they're charging their customers has gone up. Right, because their competitors are leaving, so the supply of that finished good shrinks. So the price goes up, and what they have to pay to their workers and for supplies to make that thing, now it becomes cheaper. because, again, some of their competitors are leaving, so they're not bidding up those prices as much. So if the prices they have to pay for inputs go down while what they're able to earn by charging their customers goes up, what happens? Their rate of return has increased. Instead of earning 8%, now maybe they're earning 9% and then 10% as the process continues. But then in the other sector, it's the opposite. As more producers are piling in, not only is the supply of the finished good increasing, pushing the finished price down, but now in order for them to produce more of that product, they have to hire workers. They have to buy more raw materials. So the demand for workers and raw materials in that other sector goes up. And so wages get pushed up for the kind of workers that have the skills to do whatever that second thing is. All right. And so for the producers who were originally in that sector and they were enjoying the 12% return, now they're like, oh man, we have to lower our prices because now there's more competition in this industry. And the amount we have to pay our workers, we have to pay them higher wages now, because if we don't, they're going to get bid away from us and go work for a competitor who just entered the sector. And for the electricity we use, for the specific mineral that we need for our product, now that's more expensive because these people are buying it as well. And so our costs of production are higher. And so that means the markup is now smaller. And so instead of earning 12%, we start earning only 11%, and then we start earning 10% as the process continues. And then once the rate of return is equalized in the two sectors, there's no reason for producers to keep shifting over until it stops. Okay, so that's the logic, and see how technically you kind of need to know how supply and demand curves move. You need to know that at the back of your hand to be able to do this. It's kind of like for you to learn how to do algebra, you have to know the times table, and you have to know addition and subtraction. You just kind of have to know that stuff. And then in algebra, you can start to do more complicated. Same thing here, to understand the movements and how producers are guided by profit and loss signals, you kind of just need to know what happens when supply and demand shift around with the back of your hand. Okay, so what I'm saying is, what I just walked you through, that would lead you to possibly believe that, oh, so at any given time, the market economy must have the same rate of return in all the different industries. And no, that's not true, because things aren't constant. The data are always changing, right? And so, the producers in one sector, somebody might come up with a great new idea and figure out how to produce the same product, but at a 10% lower price in terms of, you know, what he has to pay for to his workers and whatever. And so the rate of return in that sector temporarily is going to be really high. But then over time, entrepreneurs see what that guy's doing and they copy his techniques, and so then that advantage gets whittled away. So that's the idea, that there's always constant innovation. Or if customers, you know, we had that original new equilibrium and the rate of return in both sectors is 10%, but maybe one of the sectors is making cigarettes. And now all of a sudden the Surgeon General comes out and says, hey, you know, if you smoke cigarettes and you're a pregnant woman, your baby's going to have birth defects. And so now maybe a bunch of young women who were buying cigarettes say, oh, you know what, this, I got to quit, you know, because I don't want to be addicted to cigarettes if I get pregnant. And so let me just quit now and just get that out of the system. Okay, and so now all of a sudden the demand for cigarettes shifts way to the left, and so the price falls. And so instead of the rate of return being 10%, now the rate of return drops down to 7%. Okay, and so then there's a new reshuffling of producers and so on. And the price of tobacco would change and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so that's the idea, is there's always a tendency to try to whittle away those discrepancies in rates of return on invested capital. But you would never expect in the real world to see absolute uniformity, because stuff is always changing. And also, these things, remember, it's not automatic. It's not guaranteed. You're always making a forecast of what the future is going to be. You're guessing. You're anticipating what the market prices are going to be for the product at the time when you are spending money as a producer, hiring workers and buying resources, you technically don't know what the rate of return is going to be. You're just making a guess as to, well, I think I'm going to be able to make this product, bring it to market, and then sell it for such and such amount. But you might be wrong. The demand may totally change by the time you actually make the thing and get it ready to sell. Another point is, just make sure you understand, in a market economy, the producers aren't forced to do anything. So we're just talking about there's tendencies. You could say there are forces steering them, but they're not literally forced to do anything. And so, for example, I talked about cigarettes, and Rothbard explicitly mentions this in Man of Common State. Depending on the ethical views or whatever other kind of views you want to call them of the producers and investors, it's possible that there's going to be a permanently higher rate of return in some areas that are considered socially dubious relative to other ones that are socially laudable. So, for example, it's conceivable, depending on the kind of people you have in a given society, that maybe in equilibrium even, the rate of return by investing in tobacco companies is 12%, whereas if you invest in making baby bottles, you know, little bottles for babies, maybe the rate of return in that sector is 8%. And that's what I originally said. And so it's possible that there's no reason that's it, end of story, and that no investor or producer shifts out of making baby bottles or earning 8% and into selling cigarettes where they're earning 12% just because money isn't everything. And people could just, the way it could fall, the way the chips could fall, the people could say, no, I would rather invest my capital and earn 8% because I could sleep at night knowing that my money is being used to produce baby bottles, and I would rather do that than earn 12% selling cancer sticks to people. And at the same time, the people, the investors in the tobacco industry, they might have qualms about it as well, but they'd say, I just can't turn down earning 12%. You know, so yeah, if it were even, or even if it were just a difference of 1 percentage point, then yeah, I'd switch my capital over to the baby bottle sector. But I just can't, you know, they're only at 8%. I can earn 12% over here. There's no way I can walk away from that much extra money. Right? Or there might be people who don't care and say, hey, you know, I'm hardcore libertarian and I'm not judging anybody. Your lifestyle, your choice. Ayn Rand thought cigarettes were cool, you know, whatever. And you might think, this is great. I'm glad there's these strange social customs and what have you, and that I'm able to earn 10% of my money or 12%. Because these other fools are putting all their capital in the baby bottle. You know, there could be people like that too. All right, so you would still, I mean, you wouldn't think those gaps could get too big because presumably there are still going to be people who don't have such ethical qualms and, you know, they would just dominate and be more of the market, okay? So all it would take, in other words, is a few multimillionaires or billionaires who don't really care about that sort of stuff. And then they could just put all of their capital into the sectors earning 12%, but that's what it meant. Right? So it's kind of hard. You know, you wouldn't expect there to be a humongous discrepancy over time. But nonetheless, I do want to point out that it's not automatic. It's not that producers and investors are forced or have to go to where the highest rate of return is. That's technically not true. There's just a tendency. Other things equal, they will do that, but other things might not be equal. Okay, let me continue. Okay, interest versus profit. I walked through an example in the textbook. I'm going to just say it very briefly now because we've done this in fairly close detail already in this particular course, so I'm not going to dwell on this But the point, so I walked through a Christmas tree example where somebody in early January spends a bunch of money buying a crop of young sapling Christmas trees, plants them, the idea being that over the course of the year, the person doesn't need to put in any more money. He just sits back and watches these things physically mature and then sells them at the end of the year with Christmas trees and earns a revenue from that, and then you can see what the rate of return is. And what I pointed out is, even in equilibrium, the person is going to sell the Christmas trees for more than he or she had to spend on the sapling at the beginning of the year. And the point of going through this is to make sure you understand that the markup, what you might call the markup, that gap between how much do you have to pay to the workers and the inputs to make the product compared to how much can you then turn around and sell it for to the customer, that gap is not going to get whittled away to zero. So you might have thought that, and I used to think that before I read Mises, before I read Human Action, if you had asked me and said, oh, you know, in a competitive market, what will happen? I would have thought that that revenues would have gotten driven down to costs of production. If what you mean by that is the monetary expenses, I would have thought that the rate of return would be driven down to zero as long as there were no changes in the data and everything settled down. Because I would have thought, you know, if there's a gap, if you can spend $100 on inputs and then turn around and sell the product for $101. Well, how can that last? Why wouldn't everybody pile into that and make an infinite amount of money? And the reason is because there's a time lag. And that's a crucial, you know, so make sure you understand. So the reason for this is that there's a time lag. And this is a crucial Austrian point. So, you know, Paul Krugman, if you made this point to him, you know, he would think about it for a second, probably go, well, yeah, of course, who doesn't know that? But this is never reflected in their crude macro Keynesian model, this kind of thing. Okay? So it's not that a Keynesian economist would say this is wrong. It's just it's not the kind of thing they dwell on. So when I say it's an Austrian point, what I mean is it's a very important thing that Austrians stress that other economists don't even talk about because they don't even really deal with this. They're dealing it in terms of physical things and not in terms of money pricing in the accounting of it. They would say, oh, that's not economics, that's accounting. What are you doing? And one of the major points that Mises makes throughout Human Action is no, the economics of the market society or the market economy really is about accounting, or what we might call economic calculation. And that's really the fundamental thing of capitalism. And you can't just brush that aside and have a model with no money in it. All right, so again, just on this slide, what I want to reiterate is I'm trying to make sure you don't go too far, right? In the previous slide here, when I'm talking about the tendency for profits to get whittled away and everything, for economic profits to get whittled away, notice I am not saying there's a tendency for accounting profits to get whittled away. All right, so yeah, it's true. If you see one entrepreneur doing something and he or she is earning a very high rate of return, then other people will emulate that effort. But there's no reason for the rates of return to all get pushed down to zero. I guess that's a way of putting it. Yes, there's a tendency for all the rates of return to be equalized, but they don't need to be equalized at zero. They can settle down at a positive number because that number reflects time preference. If you want to think of it this way, you can say, yes, in the long run, with no changes in the data, competition does make the cost of production ultimately equal to the revenues, so long as one of the costs you include is the interest expense on the invested capital. So if that's the way you want to handle it mentally, okay, you can do it that way, in which case it would be true to say competition eradicates all economic profit. But then still, I'm just saying make sure you realize there's always going to be a gap between the total amount of dollars the producer spends on the inputs and the total amount of dollars he or she collects from the final customer when they sell the finished product or service, because there has to be some allowance to earn an interest return on the capital that was tied up, because there's always a time lag between spending money on the inputs and then producing the good or service and then selling it to the customer. So in some processes, the time lag is very short, but in other processes, it can be really long. Okay, so what's the social function of profits and losses? Mises thinks that, and I love his explanation here. So all of this stuff is very Misesian, in case that's not obvious. So yeah, I didn't dwell on the name Ludwig von Mises in Lessons for the Young Economist, but where my worldview was formed was through reading Human Action, and that's what I'm trying to distill for people in Lessons for the Young Economist. Okay, so for Mises, profits and losses are the signals to the entrepreneurs to show them how well or how poorly they are using society's scarce resources. Because in Mises' view, entrepreneur is what he called a mandatory of the consumers. Actually, I think I might be mandatory with an A, but in any event, he doesn't mean mandatory like something is required. That's not the sense of what he's using. That's what I said. I think I misspelled it, actually. He's saying it's like a representative or an agent who acts on behalf of. That's the sense in which he's using the term. And so what happens is, let me jump ahead here. I'm gonna go over these slides in different order, because now that I'm talking to you guys, I think the explanation will make more sense if I change the order. Okay, so this diagram is taken from your textbook. And this is one of my favorite diagrams of the book. All right, so I was the one who, my buddy from college is actually the illustrator for the book. It's named Sam Turod. He's probably listed somewhere in the book. And, you know, when I was explaining to him what I wanted for this diagram, I love the way it turned out. This is exactly what I wanted. Okay, so in Mises' view, so this is just putting into a cute little picture form the framework that Mises describes in words and Human Action and elsewhere in his writings. So in this framework, the entrepreneurs are in between the resource owners, the owners of the factors of production on the top, and then the consumers who are on the bottom. So you see how the entrepreneurs are in between both groups. So the entrepreneurs, the way Mises thinks of it, the consumers here are spending their money buying the goods and services that the entrepreneurs are selling to them. Now the entrepreneurs have those dollars to go into the various factory markets so they can buy land resources from the landowner. They use some of those dollars to go and hire workers and get their services. And then they use some of those dollars to the natural resource owners to get minerals and crude oil and stuff like that. Okay? So that's the idea, that the consumers don't directly make bargains with the resource owners. Right? The consumers don't go to the people who own metals, aluminum or whatever, and they don't go to the workers who make cars, and they don't go to the real estate owners and say, hey, can we put a factory on your land, and we're going to pay you for that. They don't do that. All they do is they spend their money on the finished products or services. And then it's the entrepreneurs who go into the various factory markets and then spend that money in order to bid those services, okay? So that's the Misesian vision. And so in that framework now, you can see how the entrepreneurs act as like the agent of the consumer. So it's the idea is it's as if the consumers and Mises explicitly uses this notion of democracy. He says that it's every time the consumers spend a dollar on some good, that's like a vote saying, I want more of this, or this is how much I want this thing. And so that's giving information to the entrepreneurs. And so it's ultimately the consumers and their buying patterns that guide the entrepreneurs so they know what to produce and what not to produce. So profits and losses, that is the mechanism by which the entrepreneurs realize how good a job they're doing at serving the consumers. And it's probably more subtle than you realize at first. And so that's, in order to drive home that point, that's why I had this perhaps silly example of, I say that, well, suppose there's a family business where they build apartments and then rent them out to tenants. And then, that's what the family business has been. Now the father dies and the son takes over, and the son obviously doesn't have very much business sense. And the son thinks correctly, hey, you know what? I bet you if the next building we're planning on constructing, instead of using the normal material, instead of just, putting regular carpet down and putting wallpaper or painting the walls, why don't we just coat all the interior surfaces with gold? Because I'm pretty sure that our tenants would really like that. Who wouldn't want to live in an apartment that was covered in gold? And not only would they like it, but they would pay us more, right? We could charge higher rent every month to tenants to live in an apartment that was coated in gold rather than just a regular looking apartment like we always do in the family business. Okay, so that logic, that reasoning is correct insofar as it goes. Yes, the tenants would prefer to live in an apartment that is covered in gold rather than one that's normal looking, and the tenants would be willing to pay more. So that's true. So if you just simplistically latched onto a few phrases that I've said in the lecture today, you might think, oh, well, market prices therefore will lead the entrepreneurs to start building apartment units that have the interiors coated in gold. Because didn't Murphy say that prices guide production? And you realize, I'm purposely being silly here just to make sure you think through the logic of it. So what's clearly wrong? That's obviously got to be wrong. We just kind of intuitively know that that would be a huge waste of resources. And so let's first think it through on a couple of levels. So first of all, in a market economy, why would that instantly get punished? The kid starts doing it. They start building the apartment complex, and they're quoting things with gold. And then instead of renting the unit out for $1,000 a month, he's able to rent it out for $2,000 a month. So he says, look at this. We doubled revenue. I'm awesome. He's about to go party because he thinks he's so much smarter than his dad who built the business. Well, of course, what happens is the accountant is going to pull him aside and say, hey, Junior, what are you doing, you idiot? And the kid's going to say, no, we just doubled revenue. What are you talking about? He's going to say, yeah, but it cost, 20 times as much to build the building your way than the way your dad would have built it. So, yeah, revenue's doubled, but our expenses went up by a factor of 20. And so we're actually losing a bunch of money instead of making money. What are you doing? We got to stop this. This is crazy. I can't, I was on vacation, didn't know you were doing this. Now that I get back and I'm seeing what you're doing, I'm going to tell you, you got to stop immediately. Okay, we got to, kick everybody out of the apartment and knock it down and sell the gold back into the marketplace. And that's how stupid your decision was, Junior. It's not even like, given the apartment's like, now we're just going to deal with it. We have to stop, kick everybody out, and just, demolish the place, take it apart, and sell the gold back. Because otherwise, this is crazy. We're going to lose too much money. right? So that's what they would do. So, you know, you can sort of see the logic and say, okay, this is how it's not really prices per se, but price differentials, or more specifically, profit and loss, that guides entrepreneurial action and gives people sort of a feedback signal. But and so what's a way we could describe that? What, how could we explain what happened? We could say, well, sure, the tenants, other things equal, would have liked to live in a gold building, but it's just too expensive. You know, so you don't build buildings that way. It's too wasteful, or it's too expensive. It's unprofitable, right? Those are all different true statements we could make. But now let me switch examples. What if instead I'm talking about a jeweler, you know, someone who makes jewelry? And that person could say, okay, let's take a necklace. And we could take this necklace, and let's say the two ways we're considering we can make it out of copper, or we can make it out of gold. And you might say, okay, it's true, my customers would rather wear a gold necklace than a copper necklace. Yep. My customers would pay more if I sold them a gold necklace as compared to copper necklace. I forget what the other model was. Okay. Yep. Check. Okay. So far we're in exactly the same boat as the kid that took over the family business with the apartment complex. But we know where this is going. We know that there's nothing unreasonable about making gold necklaces. And so specifically, what is it in terms of the accounting that the jeweler's accountant is not going to say, what are you doing? No, the accountant's going to come out and say, good job. That instead of you foolishly trying to sell people copper necklaces, by selling them gold necklaces, you know, maybe you increased how much they're willing to pay you by a factor of 20. And yet, the cost, how much it cost me to make the necklace, only went up by a factor of 17. I mean, I'm just making numbers up. I would have to play with it to see, because, you know, part of it's the time of the jeweler to make the thing. It's not just the metal cost, right? So I'm just obviously making those numbers up, but you get the idea that the reason, in terms of the accounting, making the gold apartment complex is crazy, is that, yeah, the revenues would go up, but the cost would go up even more. And so it would become very unprofitable. Whereas with the necklace sector, it's not crazy to make things with gold, because revenues go way up. You know, if you, instead of making a necklace out of copper, you make it out of gold, customers would be willing to pay a lot more for a gold necklace than a copper necklace. And in fact, the amount more they're willing to pay is bigger than what it costs you, the jeweler, to switch from one to the other. And so that's why you actually increase your profitability by making gold necklaces as compared to making copper necklaces. Okay, so that's what happens. And then one last little point on that before I move on. Think of this in the big picture now. How would somebody like Mises explain what's going on? He would say that, look, the consumers, yes, they like gold. They like gold apartments, and they like gold necklaces. But just given the realities, there is an important sense in which the consumers would rather that scarce amount of gold get channeled into necklaces rather than being spread all across apartments, that there's not enough gold to do that. They would rather the gold get concentrated into making necklaces and not be wasted trying to foolishly coat the inside of a bunch of apartment units. That would be a horrible waste of the gold as far as the consumer's preferences are concerned. So it's kind of a nuanced statement, and this is where you get into arguments even within Austrian circles about what exactly was Mises trying to say. And ultimately, like, the position that Mises himself takes, and that Joe Salerno, I didn't really get this until Joe Salerno hammered it home one time, he was arguing with Hayekians about this, as opposed to, you know, Hayek's knowledge problem versus Mises calculation problem, is Salernitas was saying that, no, there's this new thing under the sun, and it's called economic calculation, and it doesn't correspond exactly precisely to some fact about the physical world. It's intimately tied up with people's preferences and physical realities. And so, you know, we can't really, so that, yeah, there's a sense in which Mises is saying the consumers would rather you use the gold in the necklaces and not on the apartment buildings. But when you say, well, but really, what do you mean? What do you mean they would prefer? All you can really say is, well, in a decentralized market economy, necklace production with gold would be profitable, and apartment production with, you know, solid coated gold in the interior, at least for the masses, would not be profitable. So in a sense, you're not really saying anything more, but intuitively, I hope, you know, me dwelling on this example has gotten you guys to see what's going on. Because let me make sure you're getting this. Notice, it can't be true that gold is too expensive to use in every line of production, right? So we've seen the accountant would say to the kid taking over the family business with the apartment complexes, the accountant might say, what are you, crazy? Gold is way too expensive to be using to build apartments. Are we nuts? But that can't be true in every line of production, right? In order for gold to be so expensive, there has to be at least one entrepreneur who's buying it at those prices, right? If nobody is willing to use gold in any production process, then its price would fall. Okay, so somebody somewhere is holding up the price. And so in our example, some of the people holding up are the jewelers, and they're making gold go into jewelry. Other people holding up the price are people making coins and things like that, okay? So, or silverware that's goldware, let's call it. China that's made fancy instruments and utensils that could be coated in gold. All right, so I'm dwelling on this because I really want you to see the logic of what Mises is saying. Back to this diagram. By, you know, so for these resource owners, the people selling gold, the high price of gold, like, you know, means this guy, like maybe he's the one making necklaces and this is the guy making apartment complexes. The high price of gold is the means by which this guy makes sure that he's the one who gets the gold, because gold is supposed to be channeled into necklace production and it's not supposed to be wasted in coating apartments. And so how do you make that happen in a decentralized market? Well, that price of gold shoots up. And I think Mises even somewhere explicitly says the price of a commodity is like a signal thing, hands off to the entrepreneurs who can't incorporate that into their process profitably at those prices. Okay, so again, it's a signal. The price tag that's attached to a resource is a signal to the entrepreneurs saying, this is valuable, this is scarce. There are consumers who are paying for products or services that use this input. So if you want to use it, you can, but you better be pretty sure that whatever you're going to do with it, your customers are going to pay a lot. Because right now, this thing is valuable and it's already being used by other entrepreneurs. And so for you to bid this away so that they can't use as much of it anymore, now their customers are going to be unhappy because, you know, they're going to make less of whatever it is that they're using this thing for. So you're allowed to do it. No one's going to stop you and put a gun to your head. But if you screw up, you're going to lose money. And so in the way we communicate a relative amount of, hey, this is really scarce, are you sure you want to use this, is by the price. And so if something is really expensive, that's because it's very scarce. And that's the market's way of telling entrepreneurs, if you're going to dabble with this stuff, you better be really sure the customer wants what you're going to make with it. If you can figure out some way to make your product without using this thing, then we strongly encourage you to do that. And notice, again, that's exactly what the profit and loss mechanism induces the entrepreneurs to do. Okay, let me see. Do you guys have any questions? I have one more slide I can go over. But I don't see any pending questions. So we've got 12 minutes left. So go ahead. If you guys have questions, go ahead and type them in, and then I'll switch over. But not seeing any at the moment. Let me touch on this last slide. So the limits of economic calculation. Thus far, we've been – let me be clear. Economic calculation is the fancy term that Ludwig von Mises uses for profit and loss accounting. Okay, so it's calculation because it involves arithmetic. But it's economic because the arithmetic uses money prices. Right, so that's where this term economic calculation comes in. And so Mises has just some gorgeous passages. I mean, I realize I sound like a gushing fanboy here, but I think I've mentioned to you guys one of the main projects that I'm in the middle of is I'm writing a sort of accessible undergrad level modern statement of human action for the Independent Institute. You know, they commissioned me to do that. And right, you know, they've got the first draft of the manuscript, the people are reviewing it, and we'll go back. So I don't know when it's going to be ready, hopefully early 2015, but I don't know. Okay, but in any event, so I had to go through just very carefully rereading Human Action cover to cover for this project, because I wanted to, you know, make sure I was doing justice to the various sections when I was sort of paraphrasing what Mises was saying. And it was just blowing me away, the stuff he was talking about in terms of economic calculation in its relationship to civilization. And it was just like, wow. And so I'm paraphrasing here, but one of the things he said was something like, it's only through private property and the existence of money and money prices, and then the corresponding ability to engage in profit and loss calculation or economic calculation that allows humans to apply arithmetic to social life. Okay, again, that's I'm butchering it. He speaks in a very formal, proper language that sometimes is hard to get into the style, but once you get into it, he's a very eloquent writer. And so, but what he was trying to get at there is that he's saying the way we use numbers, like arithmetic or arithmetical operations, the way that knowledge, that branch of human knowledge of arithmetic could not really be useful to us in guiding our life in society were it not for economic calculation. It's economic calculation that is the mechanism or the door through which our knowledge and understanding of abstract mathematical relationships allows us to improve our physical lives as we exist in society. All right, so that's an extremely audacious statement. And, you know, non-economists would probably guffaw and say, oh my gosh, because you're an economist, you think the whole world revolves around the market economy of money. Oh my God. But I'm saying when you appreciate the boldness of its statement, it's breathtaking. And just to give you an idea of what he means, he's saying that – I see your question, Ronald, so I will answer that. What Mises means is that – to give you an example, he's saying, yeah, you could – without money prices, sure, you could – if you're a shepherd, let's say, you could keep track of – how many sheep you had, but even there, you know, that by itself doesn't really mean much. Like, how do you know if you lost a sheep or, you know, if a sheep is missing? You know, you know that you started the day with 18 in your flock and now you're bringing them back at the end of the day after they've been grazing all day, you're bringing them back to the pen or whatever you call it, the sheepfold, and you only have 17. Did I say 18? I hope I did. I meant to say, I'm trying to say, yeah, I forgot what number I started. Let's say you started with 18 in the morning, and now in the evening you only got 17. And how do you know if it's worth your while to go look for that 18th sheep? strictly speaking, you don't know. Just to say, well, 18 minus 17 is 1. Yeah, you know one sheep is missing, but what implications does that have? Okay, and so, by the way, that wasn't Mises' example. That's my attempt to try to get you to see what he's saying. That, and for sure, to say things like, well, should we build a bridge here or something? How would you know that? You could know how many units of wood and how much labor power and so what it would take, but you wouldn't have any quantitative way of assessing your results. Right, so you could have, like the Swiss Family Robinson, they would do stuff. Mises is not saying that people without money would just sit around and not build anything because they would say, well, we have no way of keeping a balance sheet or doing a profit loss. He's not saying that, but he's saying they would have no rational external guide on what they were doing. It would just have to be their intuitive looking at the before and the after and saying, do I think the after is better than the before? And that would be the only way they could say whether they thought they had made a good use of their resources. And so it's only with money prices that we're able to bring quantitative relationships to bear on these issues, and you could start using numbers to help guide your behavior. Okay, so having said all that, what are the limits of economic calculation? So I spent the lecture singing the praises of economic calculation, how it guides entrepreneurs. What Mises says, look, economic calculation can't do everything. And so to the extent that there are areas of our life that are very important to us, but which do not directly involve flows of money, then they don't fall within the orbit of economic calculation. So for example, this is my example, not his. Here's the Grand Canyon. So right now, the federal government owns it, I believe, or regulates it, controls it. But suppose it were privately owned. Okay. Now, the owners, the private owners, definitely could earn revenue from letting tourists come in or letting photographers come in and then, paying them for the right to take pictures and make postcards or whatever. But you could imagine that they might find it more profitable to start selling at least some of it to developers, to maybe start making tourist bigger, sort of gaudy thing, like building an amusement park right there or making a big shopping mall, start putting parking lots all over. So there's a sense in which, you could imagine a lot of Americans in particular saying, oh, I kind of just liked it the way it was. And, I wish they hadn't done that or whatever. All right. And so a lot of that stuff is not going to be directly quantified in terms of money flow. Now, it could be, I don't want to make this too complicated. The situation is actually a lot better than I just painted it, because there's all kinds of ways the market could harness those forces and clever entrepreneurs could figure out a way to somehow get, people to contribute a dollar a year or something to keep the Grand Canyon the way it is or whatever. But you can come up with scenarios where there's things that where people would really want something to be one way versus the other, even though that's not going to directly translate into them spending their money. The way that if people really want to see action blockbusters in the theater, they spend their money on them, and that's what tells entrepreneurs that that's what we're going to produce. Okay, so there's limits, but Mises' point is that's fine because economic calculation at least gives us the right answer for the area where it works. And so now we don't have to just plan everything based on hunches. We can allocate resources within the orbit of economic calculation quite rationally based on profit and loss. And then in those areas that are sort of non-economic, that don't really come in the orbit of commerce and money expenditure, those are like little oases. And we can much more clearly see what's involved and understand the relative trade-off. So economic calculation lets us know how much expense are we overlooking or how much potential revenues are we forfeiting if I'm an owner of the Grand Canyon or, an owner of a portion of it and I don't put in a shopping mall or whatever. So I don't have to, right? Remember, there's owners can do whatever they want, but economic calculation lets me know I could be earning $1 million a year in revenue if I were to allow Disney World to come in here and put up a park. And so economic calculation tells me if I choose not to do that, I'm missing out on $1 million a year. And maybe I want to do that. You know, I'm the owner. I think, no, I kind of like it the way it is. You're allowed to do that. But economic calculation just gives you an idea. It quantifies what those non-economic decisions are costing you. It doesn't mean you're forbidden from absorbing them, but it does help you understand the ramifications of your actions. So you might agree that, yeah, let's keep the Grand Canyon the way it is, but it wouldn't be the case that somebody would say, no, Central Park is so beautiful in New York City. Why don't we just expand Central Park 10 miles in every direction and turn Manhattan into a big forest or woods? Well, that would be crazy, right? The cost of that decision would be enormous. And so you wouldn't do that, right? So that's the idea. Okay, let me now, there's one question, let me answer that and then we'll wrap up. Ronald Schwartz says, please confirm or correct this. When banks lend out savings deposits, for example, a CD, there's no money created and cannot be called fractional reserve banking. However, when banks lend out checking deposits, there is money created and called fractional reserve banking. Right, that's the distinction I was making in terms of a theoretical Rothbardian world. Banks, if you want to have 100% reserve banking so that the very process of a bank granting a loan is not inflationary, that you can still do that, and banks can still make loans. It's just that if you're saving money and you want to deposit or you want to give it to the bank and then they're going to lend it out to somebody else, you can't think that you have access to that money. And so it's not that you're depositing your money in a checking account and now you see that in your balance and you think you can withdraw it on demand. No, instead you would do something like buy a one-year CD. So you know you have given up control of that money for a year. Now, if you're hard up for cash, you can take that CD and go sell it in the secondary market. Okay, so it's not that you're stuck and you have to wait the full year before you get any of the money back. You can go sell it if you want, but you're not sure what price you're going to get for it. Okay, if interest rates have gone up from when you bought that CD, the market value of it will have plummeted. And so you're not going to get the same amount of dollars back for it that you may have put in originally. If you're willing to wait for maturity, then you're going to get back what the bank promised you. Okay, so, but the point is the reason that's not inflationary is you have relinquished control of those dollars or of the money is to the bank, and then it lent it out to somebody else. So it's not a credit transaction per se that's inflationary. What's inflationary is when you give your money to the bank, you still think it's your money and it's part of your cash balances, and yet the bank then lends some of that out to somebody else. And so now it's part of their cash balances too. And so now if we add up all the total cash balances in society, the number is higher than it was before. And so that's the very legitimate sense in which the bank's activities created money out of thin air. And now if everybody thinks they collectively have more cash, well, they're going to be willing to spend more. And so that's going to push up prices. Okay, a related question. When there is a bank run, isn't there a run on both checking and savings accounts? It happened in Bailey Savings and Loan, the movie It's a Wonderful Life. Yeah, and this is the problem, you know, in terms of the theory, to try to get you guys to see the distinction, we'll say a checking account versus a savings account. But the problem is in practice, those things aren't as heterogeneous as I make it sound. And so in a true savings account where you give your money to the bank and you can't touch it, well, then there can't be a bank run. You get what I'm saying? You know, you could show them, say, give me my money. What are we talking about? Contractually, we're not supposed to give you this money. You know, you're supposed to leave it in the savings account for a year before then you can be entitled to the interest. But in practice, because banks engage in fractional reserve lending or fractional reserve banking, they often lead their customers to believe that, oh, even money that you put in your savings account or your time deposit account, don't worry about it. You can withdraw or you can transfer it to your checking. So in the modern world, there really isn't that much distinction between a checking account and a savings account. It's mostly psychological, right? I think the average person, if he puts money into his savings account, tries to forget it's there, whereas the checking account is money that, oh, I need that to, you know, buy my groceries and pay my gas bill and stuff like that. All right, but if they miscalculate and their checking account is almost gonna bounce, they'll just go online and transfer, you know, $500 from savings in an instant, or, you know, there the next day. So clearly they're viewing their savings account as also being a checking account. All right, so I don't remember to sit in A Wonderful Life exactly what the dialogue was, but I'm definitely agreeing with you that in today's world, there isn't this fine principle distinction between checking and savings. And so when I'm talking about what would happen in the guardian world, I'm saying there would have to be that true distinction. Okay, I'll stop there. Thanks everyone for tuning in, and we have our last lecture next week.